Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. I am delighted to see y'all today. I realized halfway through communion, I forgot to mention that we were going to talk in here today. So I'm glad you all clearly read the e-news and you knew what was happening. I failed to announce it in the service, but we will welcome others as they may join us. Let's begin on this, the Sunday after Independence Day, with the beautiful collect on page 820 of the 1979 Book of Common Prayer, the current prayer book for our country. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, who hast given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable industry, sound learning, and pure manners. Save us from violence, discord, and confusion, from pride and arrogance, and from every evil way. Defend our liberties and fashion into one united people the multitudes brought hither out of many kindreds and tongues. Endue with the spirit of wisdom those to whom in thy name we entrust the authority of government, that there may be justice and peace at home, and that through obedience to thy law, we may show forth thy praise among the nations of the earth. In the time of prosperity, fill our hearts with thankfulness. And in the day of trouble, suffer not our trust in thee to fail. All which we ask through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Thank y'all so much, not just for being here for this conversation this morning, but those of you who have already were at church at 9 o'clock and those who are coming at 11:15, as I said, the notices, thank you for indulging the rector in a little bit of historical liturgical cosplay, which is kind of what we're doing today. It is a wonderful thing to be able to draw on the history of the life of the church, the liturgical history of which we are heirs, and lest anyone get a little bit worried and say, hang on, doesn't the bishop have to authorize this? The bishop did, in fact, authorize the use of this service for this day. For this 250th celebration of Independence Day, Bishop Fisher, who oversees the liturgical life of the diocese for Bishop Doyle, wrote to the clergy and said, y'all can use a variety of different options for this, including the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. So what we have done this morning and what we will do at 11:15 is an authorized liturgical action. And that's kind of where I want to begin my conversation with y'all this morning, the importance of that authorization or that authority to do anything in the life of the church. We are reminded when we turn to our historical liturgies of the established nature of the Church of England. So, real quick and dirty Anglican history. Y'all remember that at the time of the English Reformation, what we had was a sort of dissolution of the relationship with the Pope in Rome, and the king became the supreme governor of the church on earth, the supreme caretaker, properly construed, of the church on earth. And that meant that Parliament, as it was sort of in its nascent period under Henry VIII and his successors, became deeply enmeshed in the life and the liturgical life of the church. It meant that liturgies had to be approved by Parliament, by law. You could not offer a liturgy that was not promulgated appropriately under the laws of England. So this meant that we had theological debates in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. We had disputes over liturgy within the political life of the English nation. And that, in fact, of course, makes up the significant portion of the history of England in the 16th and 17th centuries. It is religious disputes that drives the political changes that the nation endures. So, of course, we see that under Henry VIII, who, it's important to remember, was, well, how shall we say, he wasn't particularly interested in reform for reform's sake. He had other aims at heart. He was really quite conservative in his liturgical tastes, in his theological views. You'll remember that Henry VIII received the title of Defender of the Faith from the Pope because he wrote a book condemning Martin Luther. Right, so Henry VIII was no great friend of the Reformation theologically. He was more interested in what it amounted to politically for the crown to oversee the church in England. But he was served by a succession of bishops and ministers of state who were convicted in their hearts of the truth of this renewal movement, this reform movement for the church that had begun on the continent. And so, of course, Thomas Cranmer, Henry's Archbishop of Canterbury, was ready and prepared when Henry VIII died and his son Edward succeeded him to promulgate a liturgy in English for the English people. The very first liturgy that was produced in English was in 1547. It was the Litany. And it's very similar to the Great Litany as we see it in our prayer book today. The nation was threatened by, I believe there was an earlier version of the Spanish Armada, basically. Some Spanish ships were coming in. You needed some public prayers to ward off those Spaniards. And so they produced a litany in English to be said in English parish churches at that time. And then in 1549, under Edward VI, we had the first of the Books of Common Prayer, which, of course, when you think of the full title, which you can see if you have your leaflet, this is the consistent full title that we have here: The Book of Common Prayer and Administration of the Sacraments and Other Rites and Ceremonies of the Church According to the Use of the Church of England. That's a long title trying to express everything that this book and all of its predecessors attempts to achieve. It is first a book of common prayer, that is to say, prayer that we can hold and offer in common. Anybody who speaks our language, and indeed the prayer book has been translated into pretty much every language you can think of. I think the earliest translations of the prayer book were into Latin. So we had an English liturgy that was translated back into Latin because of the universities. Latin was the language that they used day to day. And then into Irish. The prayer book was translated into the Irish language very early because, of course, well, we know the history of England and Ireland and how they were always interacting with one another. So the Church of England was attempting already to impose a Protestant liturgy in the Irish language on the island of Ireland very, very early in its history. So it is a common prayer book. That means to say we can use it, all of us together in common, and it is therefore a binding contract, in effect, between the priest and the people. When you come into church for a prayer book service, a service from the Book of Common Prayer, you know that it's not just going to be Dane Boston riffing that day. What am I feeling like? I think we'll do a little bit of penitential. I think we'll do a little bit of joyful. You know, it's not just my opportunity to kind of let it all hang out and do what I want to do. You know that I have committed and bound myself by vows to follow what's in this book, and that we can pray together in common these words that are offered. This book, of course, also contains what is required for the administration of the sacraments. Not just Holy Eucharist, which we had this morning, but of course, baptism and the other sacramental rites, which was a big debate at the time of Reformation of what still counted. The two dominical sacraments were always maintained, Holy Eucharist and Holy Baptism. And then things that had been considered sacraments in the pre-Reformation era, things like confirmation, holy unction, marriage, the last rites, confession, things like that, they sort of entered into a somewhat grayer space. There were rites contained for those things from the earliest days of the Book of Common Prayer, but the question of whether they were full sacraments or merely sort of second-tier expressions of grace that were not on the same level as communion and baptism became a distinguishing feature of the Anglican experiment. And all of this was going to be done as the rites and ceremonies of the church, and you know, big letters, we sort of followed an 18th century typographical convention here. The church is in big letters, but it's also according to the use of the Church of England. That's an important distinction. What we are saying is all that we do is part of what the Church Catholic, small c, Catholic, the church universal in all times and all places has done. That's what we do. But we're doing it according to the particular customs, the particular rites and rituals, the particular language that has grown up in this particular place called England. So the work of the English reformers was never to establish a different branch of Christianity or a sort of different iteration of Christianity. It was simply to offer what the Church Catholic does at all times and all places in and for the context of the English nation and people. And that is what they gave us in this Book of Common Prayer, authorized by King and Parliament and endorsed by the bishops and the clergy. This is the heritage that has been handed on to us. Now, when the English Empire began its expansion, when the colonies on in the North American colonies were first planted, we remember that many of them were actually founded by people who wanted to get as far away from this as they possibly could. Right? From the beginning, the Book of Common Prayer was a controversial document. It was not something that indeed proved to be common for the extremes of the English nation. Those who wanted to see the Reformation go further, the radical reformers, and we often call them Puritans because they wanted to further purify the church. Or, indeed, for those recusant Catholics who wanted to just take things back and go back to Rome. And there were always a few of them. The English nation is sometimes described in the 18th century as suspecting a Jesuit behind every bush. Right? There's always that risk of turning back to popery. And as the English people saw themselves as more and more Protestant, that was a fear shared by many. So the prayer book was not always acceptable to all Englishmen, but the brilliance of it is the attempt to make it so that apart from those on the far extremes, you could have people with Catholic leanings and people with Puritan leanings who are willing to agree that they will say these words together. You'll be familiar perhaps with the quotation attributed to Queen Elizabeth I, who finally established the Elizabethan settlement and kind of got things stabilized after the extreme Protestantism of Edward and the reversion to Catholicism under Mary. Elizabeth is meant to have said, "I will not make windows into men's souls." I can't tell what you really believe in your heart, but if you're willing to come to church and say these prayers with your sisters and brothers in Christ, then that's enough. Right? That's enough. So apart from those extremist elements, the English nation continued to develop with this Book of Common Prayer tradition, with editions in 1549, 1552. In 1559, Elizabeth promulgated her version, and that stood with some minor adjustments until the Commonwealth period. Right, one of the features of the 17th century disputes in the Church of England and in the English politics was related to religion. Oliver Cromwell and his followers were against the Book of Common Prayer. They were against the establishment of the Anglican Church as it had developed. They were against bishops entirely. So in the Commonwealth period, there was something called the Directory for Public Worship, which is just as exciting as its title indicates. I have read it. It is not riveting stuff. But the English church sort of adopted a Presbyterian form of government and had a Calvinist flavor, a strongly Calvinist Reformed flavor. At the time of the restoration of the monarchy, with the return of, Charles II, what happened was a revision of the prayer book, which resulted in the prayer book of 1662, which is to this day the legal prayer book of the Church of England. So there has been no revision, no legally authorized revision of the Book of Common Prayer since 1662. They just changed the name of the king or queen, depending on who is on the throne. Now, of course, I will just note for the Church of England, most parishes will have an early service. Basically, their 8 o'clock service might be a 1662 prayer book service, or maybe there's a weekday 1662. Most parish churches and cathedrals use what's called common worship, which is an alternative version of the liturgy with a variety of options for their principal services on Sundays. But I will tell you one place where the 1662 remains the absolute norm is at morning and evening prayer in English parishes and in churches and cathedrals. If you go to a cathedral in England to hear evensong, it is almost certainly going to be a very faithful rendering of the 1662 liturgy. So that 1662 liturgy is what went with the British Empire across the world. That's what they carried with them through the whole course of the 18th and 19th centuries as they discovered new lands and claimed them for king and country. The 1662 prayer book was their liturgy. And that is true, of course, for those who came to the New World. Now, as I've already alluded to, and as you already know, there was a division in the English colonies of the New World. New England was composed of the people who really wanted to get away from this book and everything it stood for. The southern colonies were generally founded by faithful Anglicans. And indeed, in places like Virginia and South Carolina, where I lived for 7 years, the Church of England was the church established by law in those colonies. So that sense of establishment, of having a legally authorized church that used a legally authorized liturgy, that came to the New World with the English colonists who remained faithful to the Anglican tradition. In places like Pennsylvania, there's a sort of a mixed economy prevailed, right? Pennsylvania was a Quaker area, but you had Anglicans, you had Presbyterians, you had, once they arose, Methodists and other movements like that making their way into those kinds of places. And indeed, throughout the American colonies, there was eventually a mixture of religious practice. So even in Puritan Boston, eventually King's Chapel was established. And if you've been to Boston and you've visited it, King's Chapel is still there today. It is called that because it is the chapel following the faith of the king, not the faith of the Puritan leaders of the colony. So it was a prayer book place. It has since, actually in the 18th century, it went Unitarian, and that's a whole other rabbit hole. But it's called King's Chapel to this day because it was an outpost of the Anglican faith in a place that had been established in opposition to our tradition. We know that early Anglican congregations had to become lay-led or strongly lay-driven very quickly because it was very hard to get clergy. If you think about it, you have to have an Anglican priest, you have to have a bishop. You have to be ordained by a bishop. And there was never a bishop in the New World before the American Revolution. So that meant that to become ordained, if you were an American, you had to be trained, which you could read for orders with your rector. You could sort of prepare in the colonies. You could go back to England and go to Oxford or Cambridge and have the sort of English traditional education, which was very, very expensive. And then you had to find an English bishop willing to ordain you. Does anyone know, just as a little trivia, which bishop had authority and responsibility for the American colonies in the colonial era? Wasn't Canterbury. Seabury. Well, Bishop Seabury is the first American bishop elected, but I'm saying before the Revolution, do you know which English see was in charge of us? The Bishop of London. The Bishop of London had responsibility for the Diocese of London and all of America. I've had that. And indeed, I believe the Bishop of London in the 18th century continued to have a responsibility for all the colonies until they began to appoint bishops for specific places. So it was a significant expense and a significant effort to get an ordained clergyman who is prepared to lead services according to the Book of Common Prayer in the American colonies. There were organizations that were specifically set up to send missionary priests to this continent. So the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge and the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel were these organizations that were trying to raise up priests either in America and get them ordained in England and bring them back, or raise up priests in England and send them over. But that was a challenge for the typical parish church in the colonies where the Church of England existed. So from an early day, our church developed a pretty strong sense of lay leadership. You had to have strong vestries and strong wardens, lay people willing to oversee the administration of the church through long seasons when you might not see a minister. My curacy parish, the first parish I served, Christ Church in Greenwich, Connecticut, dates its foundation to 1749. Well, let me tell y'all, in 1749, in what was then called Horseneck, Connecticut, there was not a whole lot going on. I think strongly, and my strong suspicion is what happens, is that some Anglican minister riding circuit came through, read a prayer book service, and they date that as the foundation of the parish. And it wasn't until the 1830s they really got going. So it meant that the lay leadership of the church and also the adherence of the lay people to forms of worship they could offer when no priest was present became very important in the life of the church in the New World. Now, what am I alluding to with that? Well, at the time of the Reformation, Thomas Cranmer, when he put together the Book of Common Prayer, envisioned that the typical Sunday in a typical English parish church or cathedral would proceed as follows. You would have morning prayer, because you would have morning prayer every single day of the week. That was unvarying. So morning prayer happened every morning. That would be followed on Sundays by the litany. So you would say the whole litany every Sunday. And that would then be followed by the communion service. So morning prayer, litany, and communion was the expectation and indeed the legal requirement of every parish and every cathedral in England from 1549 well into the 19th century. The trouble, of course, was that they took communion very seriously. Y'all who were there at 9 heard the exhortation that was read before you came for communion. In case you missed some of the highlights, let me just read a little bit of that for you. Dearly beloved in the Lord, ye that mind to come to the Holy Communion of the body and blood of our Savior Christ must consider how St. Paul exhorteth all persons diligently to try and examine themselves before they presume to eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For if we receive the same unworthily, we are guilty of the body and blood of Christ our Savior. We eat and drink our own damnation, not considering the Lord's body. We kindle God's wrath against us. We provoke him to plague us with diverse diseases and sundry kinds of death. You wanted to be ready before you received the sacrament. If you heard that every time it was celebrated, you would really want to be ready. So as a result, an unintended consequence of this high view of communion was that fewer and fewer people considered themselves worthy of receiving it. Fewer and fewer people brought themselves to the communion to receive it. And it meant that most Anglican Christians would come to morning prayer and the litany and what was called the anti-communion, the first part of the service, where they would hear the epistle and the gospel and the sermon. And then, if no one was ready to receive communion, in which most weeks there was no one presenting himself or herself, they gave a blessing and that was the end. You went home or you had some lunch and then you came back for evensong, but you weren't going to stick around for a communion service you weren't going to participate in. So that actually lent itself very well to the American colonial context where clergy are hard to come by, because morning prayer and litany are things that a lay reader, a licensed lay reader, can lead and offer in a church. And that became the norm for most American churches in the 18th century all the way through to the revision of the 1979 Book of Common Prayer, really, when that tradition shifted to a more Eucharistic-oriented offering. In a typical colonial Anglican church, the prayer book services would be extremely reserved, extremely staid, extremely formal. Colonial Anglicans wanted to differentiate themselves from those enthusiastic Methodists and others who were sort of growing up around, who were a little bit too fire and brimstone, right? The colonial Anglicans had a reasonable, rational religion. And I don't mean that it was an insincere religion or it was merely a religion of the mind. It was ordered. It was beautiful. It was dignified. It was reserved. If you visit a colonial parish that exists to this day, if it has not been completely ruined by the Victorians, what you will find is a space that looks like it might be another Protestant denomination. Could be Presbyterian or maybe Methodist. Clear glass windows, often a very prominent pulpit, and a very small and relatively insignificant communion table. Again, reflecting the fact that communion would have been happening maybe once a quarter at the most. You will see that the furniture of the place is designed not principally for seeing the liturgy happen, but for hearing the word preached. Right? Colonial Anglican churches are preaching boxes. They are really there for the minister to be able to get up and give a sermon. One of my favorite colonial churches is in Newport, Rhode Island. Trinity Church in Newport is the only church on this continent that I am aware of that maintains the triple-decker center aisle pulpit. So you walk into Trinity Church, Rhode Island, Newport, Rhode Island, and what you see in front of you is a reading desk, a desk for the minister, and a wine glass pulpit with a massive, great sounding board over it. That's the whole focal point of that space. And that reflects the way the liturgy would have been offered in those days. The clerk or lector is what it basically was, but the person appointed to help lead the service with the minister, the layperson, would have sat at the reading desk. The rector had his own stall right above it, and most of the service would have been a duet between those two people. It would have been the rector reading his part and the clerk answering on behalf of the whole congregation. Then at the time of the sermon, the rector would have gotten out of his stall, put off his surplice, and taken on his black gown. So I tried to illustrate that today with my little costume change in the middle of the service, and walked up the 10 steps into that wine glass pulpit where he would have delivered a sermon. Probably, you know, not being crazy like those Methodists, it would only have lasted 45 minutes, maybe an hour. Preaching was a major feature of the life of the church in colonial and 19th century America. That emphasis on the word preached was significant. And I'm reminded of a story, I think it was Bishop Meade of Virginia in the mid-19th century, who told of a time that he went to give a visitation in a far-flung parish. And he wrote in his diary, I preached for them 2 hours in the morning, and they clamored that they might have another sermon in the afternoon. So he preached for them 3 hours in the afternoon, and they asked that he might keep going, right? I think that doesn't reflect Bishop Meade's tremendous skills as a preacher as much as it does there wasn't a whole lot else going on in rural Virginia in the 1840s or 50s, whenever that was. But what we see in the architecture of the space, it reflects the kind of liturgy that the prayer book tradition hands on to us. It's something that is intended to be understood, intended to be common, intended not to be a priest in a beautiful jewel box of a space whispering to an altar by himself, but something that is openly said in the sight of all the people, open and available to all people who are willing to conform themselves to this way of being and praying together. One last thing I want to comment on related to our services this morning and what we have seen in the colonial era, and that is music. So music is so important to our Anglican tradition. The choral tradition of the English cathedrals and of the great parish churches really is sort of stands in an unbroken line from the Reformation, the pre-Reformation era, right? Monks and colleges of clergy would have sung the services in their churches, and some lay people would come to hear it. And at the time of the Reformation, there were no more monks, but still colleges of priests and boy choristers would have continued to sing the services just as they had done for centuries. That's the roots of choral morning prayer and choral evensong in our tradition. It's just basically what they have been doing for about 1,000 years before the Reformation even ever happened. That choral tradition continued into the 17th and 18th centuries, but was impossible to maintain in most parish churches and indeed on the American frontier. As the empire expanded, it was very, very hard to have a full choral tradition. So most of the Anglican churches in the colonial era would have had perhaps a small choir in the gallery that could help lead the singing of the psalms and some elements of the service in morning prayer. And then this new notion of the congregation singing hymns began to creep in about the middle of the 18th century. There's some before that, but there became popular hymns that people would know or could have lined out for them. So a leader would sing a verse and the congregation would respond, and the leader would sing the next verse and the congregation would repeat it, right? It's not a particularly satisfying way of singing hymns, but you can learn them very quickly that way and find that it's possible for the whole congregation to join in. You would, if you read the rubrics of this service very carefully, you may have noticed that there's really no place that hymns are authorized in the 1662 liturgy. So we amended traditional practice to include them in a few places in our service today. It seems that in the colonial era, a hymn before the service and a hymn after the service had become normative, but not really as part of the liturgy, just as a popular devotion of the people. So y'all are all getting ready for church. You know, the priest is back there still putting on his stuff. Let's sing a hymn together before things get started. It does seem that organ preludes and postludes have become popular, but again, just as something that the organist might offer before and after the service. The singing of psalms in the offices did continue to be an important part of the life of the church, but was often done with metrical psalters, that is to say, translations of the psalms that were set to have the cadence and rhythms of poetry. And we preserve some of those in our hymnal to this day. Some of our hymns are metrical psalms that date back to this era, when people were singing the psalms, but according to a translation that would allow them to sort of treat them as hymns. We did have the choir sing the Sanctus and the Gloria today, and that's something that might have happened in a very well-resourced, very advanced liturgically colonial church, that you might have a choir good enough to offer the kind of choral music that was being published at that time. And if you noted the rubric or the attribution, you will see that the music that the choir sang today was published in 1760. So some of it was just in time for this era that we're trying to recall. The anthems that the choir offered today were by an American composer, William Billings, who was active at this time, and in addition to the beautiful sacred anthems that we heard today, composed some marvelous patriotic anthems, including my personal favorite, his Lament for Boston. It's my last name. It's a little joke. But it's actually a really wonderful piece of music that he imitates Psalm 137 and says, basically, you know, we hung up our harps and wept for thee when we remembered thee, O Boston. And it's lamenting the occupation of the city of Boston by British forces during the Revolutionary War. That's a beautiful piece. You can look it up on YouTube and listen to it. So music in the colonial era was not nearly as integrated into the service as we have it on a normal basis and as we had it today. But we wanted to sort of use some music that was true to the era and give a nod to what the common practice might have been in a very, very well-resourced, advanced, large city parish like a Christ Church Philadelphia or St. Philip's in Charleston, something like that, someplace where you had the resources to offer great music. So that is my very quick and dirty introduction to Anglicanism in the colonial era and the use of the prayer book in the founding of our nation. Are there any questions that y'all have based on what you saw this morning or what you're about to see? Yes, Mark.
How is that Dr. Bill standing off to the side?
Yes. Great question. Thank you. The North End celebration. I forgot to talk about that. Yeah. So at the time of the Reformation, English churches looked a lot like St. Martin's, except that this whole business of a choir behind the altar, that would have been unheard of. The altar would have been against the east wall, right? That was the norm basically throughout England and indeed throughout Catholic Europe. I mean, every place would have had the altar would be the focal point at the high altar at the end of the church on the east wall. It gave the sense of the priest, you know, making intercession for the people. That's what it's intended to indicate. But of course, to a lot of people, it just meant like the priest was up there doing some hocus pocus that no one could see and no one could hear and no one knew what was happening. So at the Reformation, one of the major differences that happened in English churches was a reconfiguration of the furniture. Altars in many places were completely taken out and broken down. Stone tables, they didn't want that. That seemed far too papistical, right? That seemed far too Catholic. So they would get rid of some of those stone altars and replace them with a simple wooden table. Dignified, beautiful, but clearly just a table. And then Cranmer had the idea of, well, hang on, when the family gathers around the table, they really gather around the table. Especially as fewer and fewer people came to communicate themselves, the tables were often placed not against the east wall, sort of long ways, but they were brought into the midst of the chancel and placed short ways. So if I'm not expressing this very well. So if you imagine it, instead of having our altar as it is today, you're seeing the long front of it. Imagine it were brought down to the floor and turned so that it was end to end pointing towards the organ. Right? That's the look that many English churches adopted. And so when the rubric stipulated put the celebrant at the north end of the table, it meant that you were standing on the long side of a table in the midst of the body, and everyone could see what you were doing. Your back was not to anyone. It wouldn't have occurred to them in those days to stand what's called versus populum, that is to say, behind the table facing the people. That's our normal practice here. That's not a concept that they were familiar with in those days, but they were trying to avoid the ad orientem, the east-facing position that was traditional for the Catholic Mass. And so the rubric said, put the priest at the north end of the altar where everyone can see what's happening. So we have a traditional oriented altar, which means that, Jordan was at the short end of it, on the north end. But ultimately, that was intended to be, that would be the long end if the altar were turned, if that makes sense. Great question, Mark. Thank you. I've forgotten to note that. Yes, sir.
Could you talk about the evolution of the current day vestments?
Yeah. So vestments were extremely controversial in the Reformation era. You had the traditional Catholic Mass vestments that all Christians were used to seeing before the Reformation. And then at the Reformation, there was this debate of, well, do you need different clothes for the clergy at all? Some people, the radical reformers, said, no, get rid of them entirely. It just introduces a barrier between the priest and the people. The more moderate Reformed traditions, like ours, said, hang on, there's a value in indicating the role and responsibility of a person by the kind of clothes he puts on. And think of this in the English system. To this day, barristers wear a gown and bands, right? I mean, the king at his coronation has all kinds of vestments that he puts on. I mean, there's a tradition of indicating a person's function through that person's clothes. And so the English church said, hang on, we need to take a more moderate course here. Let's preserve the use of some of the vestments that have a function of setting apart someone for a special ministry, but not those vestments that say this person is endowed with certain authorities or powers that are sort of semi-supernatural or mystical. So things like the chasuble, which we wear on a typical basis, that was perceived to be a vestment of sacrifice. You're offering the sacrifice of the Mass at the altar. So the Reformers didn't like it. They got rid of it, by and large. But something like the white surplice that just, this is an ordinary daily dress of the clergy in the Reformation and early modern period. The surplice was just a way of taking off this black garment, which is I wear in the street or to teach with or to preach with, and to put on a white garment to show I'm ready to say the prayers. I'm ready to lead the people in prayer by this pure white garment I've put on. The hood that we wear in the service is really just a vesture from university days. It comes from the academic context, and pretty much every priest in this era, not every priest would have been a graduate, but the majority of priests would have been graduates. So they're just putting on what they're used to seeing on a normal basis. And the tippet, that black scarf that we put on, is, again, a marker that this is an ordained person rather than a lay person. You'll notice some of our choir members had their hoods on, but they don't have tippets because they're not ordained. Right, so there's the distinction there. In the 19th century, basically, some Anglicans started to say, we know that the chasuble is not a sacrificial garment. It adds to the beauty of the service, and it's part of our tradition. So things like the chasuble or the cope, which I like to wear on high feast days, we have a beautiful white cope. Those things began to be recovered in the ritual movement that followed the Oxford movement in the 19th century and became basically general in the mid to late 20th century in the Episcopal Church. But it was a pretty late adoption for most places. I'm sure it was in living memory that chasubles were first used at St. Martin's. I don't know when. No one has told me, but I was going to say, look at the portraits of our previous rectors, and you can see Russ is the first one to wear a stole in his portrait. All the rest are wearing traditional Anglican garb. Dr. Bagby's in his academicals, but still that's very traditional garb. So it's a relatively late introduction, some of those things. Yes, sir? Yes.
I went to Palmer Church for 50 years, 40 years, and every January we honored the Scots, because as I understand it, we would have the Scot bagpipe come into the service and start it and end it. And as I understand it, when we needed a bishop in order to have a president and so forth, they needed a Bible and a bishop. England would not send a bishop because we would not give alliance to the king. So for the Scots sent a bishop over here to establish the Episcopal Church. That is why when the Episcopal Church, the president goes to take his oath to the office, across from the White House is the Episcopal Church, where they go for the tradition of the Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would do is we honored all of the clans and the colors, and you would wear the clan that you could trace your clan back with the color of the Scots that you were a heritage of.
Yes. So I'm a big fan of the Kirkland and the Tartan, which is a wonderful tradition. So it's a little bit later than the period we're kind of looking at today, but after the Revolution, you can't go to the Bishop of London anymore if you're now an independent American, and yet we need a bishop to make more priests for this continent. So the clergy of Connecticut, with no one having authorized them to do this, I always note, they just kind of got together and said, hey, we need a bishop. Let's elect one of our member and pay for him to go to Great Britain and get ordained a bishop. So that man was Samuel Seabury. He was a priest in the Diocese of Connecticut. An ardent loyalist. He had not been a fan of the Revolution, but he stayed in Connecticut. He stayed in America. He kind of got on board with this whole independent republic thing that we had going on. And he was elected by his colleagues to go to England and try to find a bishop. He needed three. He found three bishops who would ordain him as a bishop. And no one in England could do it. Not just that they wouldn't do it, they couldn't do it because the Church of England was the church established by law, and part of the ordination rite of a bishop is taking an oath of loyalty to the king. So they're saying, well, unless you can take this oath, we can't ordain you a bishop. And he's saying, well, I can't take that oath, but I really need to become a bishop. So finally, the solution that was settled upon was that Samuel went north to Scotland, where there exists the Scottish Episcopal Church, which in Scotland is not the established church by law, because Scots are traditionally Presbyterian. The Church of Scotland is a Presbyterian church. So the Scottish Episcopal Church was this sort of smaller body within Scotland that held the Anglican faith and was not by law established. It required no oath of loyalty to the British king. So Samuel Seabury could be ordained a bishop by these Scottish bishops and come back to America and begin the episcopate, an American episcopate in the Diocese of Connecticut. He was very shortly followed by William White, who was the rector of Christ Church, Philadelphia, and chaplain of the Continental Congress, and known well to many of the founding fathers, who was elected in the Diocese of Pennsylvania and sent to England, and the British Parliament amended the law to permit the bishops to ordain missionary bishops for other jurisdictions, basically allowing them to ordain a bishop who didn't have to swear an oath of loyalty to the British king. So the Scots are very, very important in our history. And indeed, if you look at the Episcopal shield, if you've ever noticed the Episcopal shield, we have the red cross of St. George on the white background. But up in the upper corner, we have the blue cross of St. Andrew with the nine original dioceses. It is nine little crosses making the Psalter cross of St. Andrew in honor of our Scottish heritage that way. So I'm a big fan of the Kirkland and the Tartan, though. And any chance we had to wear my kilt and bring in some bagpipes, we're going to do it. So think about that. Yes.
The first time a chasuble was worn here was a Christmas Eve service. Larry Gibson was the rector, and it was an unusual sight. Anyway, that's the first time it was done here at St. Martin's that I recall.
Thank you so much. That's great context. There were riots in parts of London when chasubles were first worn and candles were put on the altar. Did you notice we had no candles or crosses on the altar today? That was unheard of in Anglican churches until the late 19th century. And there really were places where people would like get a gang together and say like, St. Dunstan's is going to do this crazy new service. Let's go there and throw mud at the guy when he walks in his crazy. I mean, they did. There were riots. It was considered, popery, and we didn't want anything to do with that. So look how far we've come in understanding that we can have some of those beautiful things and not betray our Reformed principles. Thank you all so much. This is so much fun. I really, really enjoy this time together. Thank you.